Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and yes, it is Friday, which means time for the Week in Review, beginning with a report out this week that if you're applying to UMass Amherst, it might be better to be an out-of-state student than in.
Going to UMass Amherst, it's close to $30,000 all in. It's about $48,000 for an out-of-state student. When you start adding up the $16,000 differential, that's pretty attractive for the school to get that money in the doors.
And that's Mary Connaughton from the conservative-leaning Pioneer Institute that authored the report. She found that UMass accepted out-of-state students with lower GPAs and SAT scores than in-state students. UMass Amherst told us in a statement that their in-state enrollment is higher than other state systems and that increasing out-of-state students has helped the school offset a decline in funding from Beacon Hill. But State Senator Michael Moore pushed back and said, that's not fair.
As it is, we have limited resources, and those resources should be focused on our kids.
So a really great story to get us started today. And joining us is Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston Magazine and a columnist for the Boston Globe and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas page. Renee, it's great to see you.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis. He's executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, it's good to have you back as
well.
Good
to be with you.
And once again, since the Pioneer Institute did author this report about UMass Amherst, just want to fully disclose that since Jim is the executive director there. But because of that, I'm actually going to give Renee first crack at this. So what do you make of what the Pioneer Institute found?
Yeah, I took a look at the study, and, you know, the differences aren't huge in SAT scores and GPAs for the out-of-state students compared to the in-state. But, you know, but it's a matter of public basic fairness. I mean, let's face it, the people of Massachusetts are the ones whose taxpayer dollars are supporting this system. And, you know, to have them squeezed out possibly by out-of-state students who are less qualified just because they can pay the full freight, you know, it's just not fair.
Well, you heard that piece of tape from Michael Moore saying, but we have limited funds to begin with, right?
So it is true that the, you know, this also brings up the great inequities and problems that the entire public education system has, the higher education system has in the state. We've been underfunding it for years. And you know, in a way, you can't blame the individual institutions for trying to, you know, maximize the dollars when Beacon Hill has not been forthcoming. But I know that some states have caps on the number of out-of-state mm-hmm. students they'll take who pay full tuition. And, you know, and perhaps that's something to take a look at. I don't know. Yeah. What does Jim think on
well,
that?
Well, Jim, before I turn to you, I just want to play another piece of tape here from Mary Connaughton again from Pioneer. And she told us on Tuesday that she really thinks that this report is highlighting questions that we should be asking about the mission of these schools.
All things being equal, if it's a state university, I would hope that they would admit the state kid, the kid, the resident, before an out-of-state kid, because it's their home. It's where they kind of count on going. Not to admit them because an out-of-state kid got it, it just seems like, you know, if you're a parent, it's heartbreaking. You're a kid, it's heartbreaking.
So basically what Renee was saying a second ago, Jim, chime in.
It's amazing the number of letters and emails that we got as a result of this and how many people actually reached out and said, my daughter, you know, had 3.94 and a 1,400 SAT score and she didn't get in and really disappointed. And thank you for taking a look at this. Look, I think this is about really understanding what the strategic direction of the university is. And what I mean by that is Michael Moore makes a very good point in saying they are investing a lot. Investment state subsidies for UMass have gone up by 40% since 2013, from $520 million to $720 million. They feel like they're carrying their fair share. Perhaps there were years before that where there was less investment. So I think they're trying to make up some room there. What I would say is the out-of-state students are also different in quality in some ways. What I mean, not the quality of how well they do in school, but a whole set of programs are being set up to actually welcome them. That's very different. You're talking about building dorms. You're talking about policing. You're talking about all kinds of life activity type stuff that changes the coloration, the kind of capital investments that have to be made at the universities. And the big question for us also to consider is, are we building for them? Are we building for our future? That is the future here in Massachusetts. What I mean by that is if you take a look at graduations from high school in Massachusetts, we expect them to continue to decline over the coming years. By 2031, there'll be about 7,000 fewer high school graduates. Uh-huh. So what are we trying to do here is a very important conversation.
Okay, so to that point, let me just read something that UMass Amherst said to us in a statement, right? They said, creating a diverse educational environment that includes students from across the country and the world is invaluable in preparing our young people to succeed in a highly competitive global economy and to nurture a civil society. Okay. Now, let me supplement that with a caller that we heard from when we had a conversation about this earlier this week. It's from Madison was her name. She's from Cohasset. She's a Massachusetts resident and currently in college. And she said that when she was applying to schools recently, she actually liked it, that it was more competitive for in-state students applying to UMass.
As a lower-income student, I loved the fact that UMass was more competitive, and I loved the fact that it was drawing in the best students from Massachusetts, because I felt like this was not only a good option, but this was also going to be an option for me that was attracting the best students from the state.
Respond to that, Jim.
Sure. I think that's absolutely to point. The thing that we would say on this is we were not even looking for a cap per se. I think the cap is a blunt instrument. Mm-hmm. California is much more enlightened on this. They had the same sort of issue. The state auditor found that they were doing exactly what UMass is doing for the very same reasons. It's a national issue,
yeah.
Right? And what they did is they decided that the students that would be accepted from outside the state would have to be above the average of all the in-state accepted students. And I think that's a reasonable policy to put into place to say that, yes, we want highly competitive people from Massachusetts, but we want highly competitive people from outside of Massachusetts.
I see. And if you're talking about opening up to the other 49 states, certainly we can find students who are, like you said, with higher scores, right?
I would make even one more point, which, because every story has many sides.
Yeah.
I myself was an out-of-state student who came to Boston to go to school, not to the public university, but still. And I stayed here, and I think a lot of out-of-state students are attracted to Boston's universities and become part of the economic fabric here in Massachusetts and actually, you know, can be, you know, productive members of the Massachusetts society. And so I think, you know, you don't want to shut the door on out-of-state students either.
Well, and we haven't even talked about the additional wrinkle that comes with international students,
right.
for example, because their tuition rates are even higher. But I want to dig into something that we touched on a little earlier, a little bit more, and that is when UMass Amherst is saying, again, in a statement, that one of the reasons why they've increased out-of-state student numbers is because it's helping the school offset, Jim, declines in funding from Beacon Hill. I mean, Renee did touch on that earlier, but they keep... UMass Amherst isn't the only state educational institution to point this out, but if Beacon Hill isn't going to step up and increase how it's supporting the schools, what other options do they have?
All right, so a couple things. One thing is I do think they are. The last 4 years is plenty of data on that. Second thing is what UMass Amherst and the rest of the system don't want to admit or even look at is the fact that the state has been sneaking them money in different guises. So if you take a look at the billion-dollar life Science Initiative before, fully $250 million that went to their capital projects. Charlie Baker with his baby bioscience initiative at $500 million, $150 million last we saw in the write-up of it, was going to go to UMass for capital investments. Mm-hmm. Now, to cry poor mouth in that, guys, and at the same time make strategic decisions that will bulk up your operating costs because now you're going to have dorms and all the other things is changing the coloration and the mission of the university. And all we're saying is, let's have a public conversation about it and maybe making sure that out-of-state students are at least at the equivalent of the in-state students. And finally, to have that conversation, I think Charlie Baker as governor has to take a look at the composition of the board of trustees. Every single one of those board of members of the board, last I looked, were alumni of the university.
Uh-huh.
People who are alumni of institutions tend to want to do empire building. Our view is make it a little more statewide, make sure we're delivering for Massachusetts. And that includes out-of-state students and international students. And I agree with the young student who said, I really liked it. Sure. Absolutely.
Renee, do you want to get one more crack at this?
It's just a little bit of a chicken-egg thing, it appears to me, or occurs to me, that, you know, the universities feel they have to make these investments in their dorms and in their labs and, you know, in their sports facilities and all of these things in order to be able to attract more students who can pay the full tuition. And, you know, it just becomes a kind of, you know, self-perpetuating problem.
Okay. One more just UMass story. This is not regarding UMass Amherst, but we should note that in the wake of the Mount Ida purchase, state legislature legislators are contemplating regulations that would require UMass President Marty Meehan to seek approval from the legislature before making any land purchases. Right now, you were talking about Board of Trustees a second ago, Jim. Right now, Meehan only needs approval from the board.
Right.
Now, the Herald is reporting that State Senator Kathleen Ives is pushing for the reforms and more accountability from the UMass President's office. Meanwhile, students and faculty at UMass Boston again asked this week at Beacon Hill, on a Beacon Hill meeting, for more support and answers on who's going to lead the UMass Boston campus. I mean, Jim, just your quick thoughts on that.
My quick thoughts are I don't know of another state where you can actually open another campus, and essentially that's what we're doing by taking over Mount Ida without legislative approval, because inherent in that, implicit in that, are a whole set of operational and capital costs. If you know what the buildings look like at Mount Ida, there's a lot of work to be done there. So all that's in the deal. I mean, I'm talking about mold and other things that are mm-hmm. in the building. So that is odd to me, that the legislature's on the hook. It feels like the MBTA at the end of the 1990s, where they would spend and say, please fill our coffers. There needs to be a much better way of approaching that, I think.
Renee?
Well, you know, I think that Marty Meehan has mishandled the Mount Ida sale, to a fairly well. I mean, and his moves have further exacerbated inequalities in the system. I mean, it's just been a terrible mess. I'm just not sure that getting the legislature to wade in to micromanage decisions at this level is necessarily the answer. I just, you know, I believe in expertise. I think we need to leave, you know, mostly let people who are experts run their operations. You don't want the legislature in there making, overseeing, or looking over the shoulder on every decision.
Mm, okay. Well, before we wrap up with the things related to UMass, looks like I might have misspoken earlier, and I have a note here that says international student tuition is the same as out-of-state tuition. There's just an extra immigration-related fee for international students. Okay. So on to another story of the week. A new report out of UMass Boston on the academic side of things is advising against building a flood protection barrier in the Boston Harbor. The report took a look at three potential or proposed barriers, including one that would nearly be 4 miles long from Winthrop to Hull, and basically saying it was a big gamble for the city and would be very expensive, but perhaps not very effective given long-term climate change issues. So Paul Kirshen, the study's lead author and professor of climate adaptation at UMass Boston, suggests other shore-based solutions.
One is we can build structures to keep the flooding away, so-called protection. The other thing we can do is accommodate the flooding, like elevating buildings, living with water. The third things we can do is retreat or move away from the water.
All of which also actually sound fairly intense to me, Renee, but your thoughts.
I actually went to a presentation that Paul Kirshen gave on Wednesday that the Boston Harbor Now had a whole day of discussions about resilience and also in equity in our sort of public realm around the waterfront. So it was very timely, this report. You know, and he did point out the very low cost-benefit ratio that would come with this. And I'm sure there is a lot of sighs of relief at City Hall and the State House that a $10 billion solution is not, you know, being presented as the preferred option.
You mean we don't need a big dig for Boston Harbor?
Yeah, everybody's got a headache on a big dig, except, okay, so I don't want to get into defending that right now. And it also would take many, many years to build this whole superstructure, and we don't have that kind of time. What it does say to me, this report, is that we have to double down and really invest and be creative in these, the professor said, these shore-based solutions. And we've already started them, you know, in East Boston and in Charlestown and some other places. There are many, many interesting things, creative things, other countries, the Netherlands, those people have got that stuff figured out. So you don't have to reinvent the wheel here. I think there's a lot of things that we can be doing that would also sort of help us reclaim our urban waterfront landscapes could actually be a very creative, improvement on what we have today.
Yeah. So, you know, in a previous life, I studied engineering, and flood barriers were like a thing I spent a lot of time looking into. And they're wonderful engineering projects, right? I mean, they could provide economic stimulus because they create a lot of jobs, et cetera. They're also like, there's something you can wrap your mind around, right? Because you're just looking like, we're going to put a barrier here, we're going to hold back the water. But we're already seeing right now in some well-established flood barriers around the world. I'm just thinking of the Thames River Barrier in London that in 2017 closed 50 times already. It's not supposed to close more than that because it chokes the river behind it. And that's already happening. So now they have to think, well, what are we going to do now if we have to permanently close the barrier? And I just wanted to share that because the Thames Barrier, I think, was built something in the 1980s here. So we know that 10, 20, 30 years from now, the $8 billion investment that we might have made in Boston Harbor, it just isn't going to be a long-term solution. So, Jim, just I wonder what your take is on here. I mean, shore-based or just,
Look, I thought the
Venetian
study was...
canals?
Let's not laugh.
I think that we really need to start looking at welcoming the water into the city and looking at the natural flows of hydro, you know, whatever, and see where we can start living with their water.
Go ahead. Yeah. So one thing I would say is that the levees in New Orleans teach us a lot about infrastructure that's built at a different time for the future.
Right? Yeah.
So, a couple of things. One is that your discussion of the Thames is actually to point because one of the things in the report that came out very clearly is that our weather incidents are different from other places, much more frequent, and actually having to open and close the mechanisms over time. At some point, you not only disrupt the environment repeatedly, but you should expect some sort of breakdown, right? So, and I think the other thing is anyone who's worked on a mega project, and this certainly would be a mega project, has to have in front of his or her head the fear that once you start talking about $10 billion, you're talking about federal, state, and local permitting. You're talking about you're saying 2050, we'll expect it like 2100.
And by then it'll have to be even bigger. Yeah.
And then you don't have the opportunity and all the money to do the other things.
What I appreciated about this report is it got me thinking like, okay, if we're thinking big, if we're thinking what are the pros and cons of an $8, $9, $10 billion project, that's good. We should be analyzing that. But that also shows us that given the right circumstances, we can muster the political and economic support for big ideas. But the question is, what is the right big idea, short of curbing climate change globally, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, none of these solutions, none of these adaptations to climate change ought to be instead of trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, I don't think these are, you know, mutually exclusive at all. And so I need to put in that caveat all the time. We still need to be doing these other things. But there are a lot of opportunities to, you know, adapt to climate change in ways that would make a more beautiful, more accessible, more resilient public realm. And these are shore-based solutions.
Okay. So we just got enough time. I want to do one more quick hit on the results of a WBUR poll out this week. And just let's focus on the gubernatorial race here because Governor Charlie Baker, I guess the question is most Massachusetts residents are wondering he may be running against who exactly? Because he's very, very popular. And here's Steve Cazella, president of the Mass Inc. polling group, which conducted the poll.
We paired him up against both Jay Gonzalez and Bob Massey and found him with a 40-point lead against either potential Democratic challenger.
Jim Sturgis, what do you think?
I think Charlie Baker expects to have a very close election because he won last time by 40,000 votes, and 40 points is not what it's going to be. And no one knows who they are, and no one actually knows who's running against Elizabeth Warren either at this point. And I just don't think people have kicked in with their interest yet. I would say, and this includes to some degree the governor, this is not the most charismatic field out there in terms of talking about the future, right? So it's going to be hard for folks to punch through who don't have name recognition given that. These are not people like Bill Weld or Deval Patrick who understand the theater of politics. So, I think they'll have a tough run. I do think the most important thing is they will continue to be cash starved.
Very much so.
So.
Yeah. I mean, they don't have that much time between the September primaries and the November election.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I would have liked to have seen a poll actually that looked at the other primary challengers and, you know, tried to give them a little bit of ink as well. I mean, those people are really not getting the attention they deserve. The thing that I found most interesting, though, about the poll, if you look in the interior of it a little bit, is that Charlie Baker is actually 1% more popular among Democrats than he is among Republicans. Like his popularity as in job approval rating, whatever, was the number might not be exactly right, but it's like 67% among Democrats and 66 among Republicans. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he's less popular. He has more unfavorables in his own party, 20% or something, than he does among Democrats.
Well, we saw what happened at the Republican convention, right? I mean, 28% of Republican convention delegates went for Scott Lively, who is really far right. So maybe we should be asking what might happen in the Republican primary, Jim.
Well, you know, just to stay on the Democratic convention coming up for a second, I do think the best outcome for the party, for both Jay Gonzalez and Bob Massey, is that if, and I think everyone expects that Gonzalez will get the lion's share of the votes, I think that's what I've been hearing. But it would to have Massey get at least 30%, I think, would be important. So they actually have a series of debates. There's some sort of, you know, they agree on just about everything. They've got to at some point distinguish themselves so voters actually understand who that person is and says, I know that person.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've got just enough time to wrap up today with our hubbubs. And those are the stories that didn't make it above the fold. But Renee, what do you want to share with us?
Well, you know, this also has to do with investing in our public waterfronts. I've just come back from a week in Paris. Don't hate me. And so I was interested to see that the mayor of Paris, whose name is Anne Hidalgo, is going to be in Boston this weekend to get an award from the Charles River Conservancy because she has brought back to Paris free public swimming in the Paris canals. And, you know, so this is like for the first time since 1923, they've cleaned up the water in the Parc de Villette area enough so that there's a kind of man-made it's like almost like a dock containing a big public freshwater outdoor swimming pool of the canal. And something like 1,000 people a day would show up to swim there last year. It's incredibly popular. It's just something that I know that the many people in Boston are taking a look at. And I think that Paris really provides a workable model for us.
That sounds great.
It's very cool.
Especially as summer's coming up. Like more places to be outside and swim would be wonderful. Jim, your hubbub.
So this is in honor of Renee's husband, who has a fascination for Japan. My hubbub is about a couple of Japanese melons. The punchline first.
Actual melons.
Two very prestigious Yubari melons. Went for $30,000 at a Japanese auction. Now, no country fetishizes food or makes it a status symbol like Japan. The French are a distant second. The obsession runs deep. You just have to watch their TV commercials, their movies. I mean, they've made Westerns about the search for the best ramen noodles, movies about a Japanese-Korean love affair that turns on omelets stuffed with rice. And a movie last year was about an uptight office guy who has this obsession with sweets to the point that it leads to a sequence of swing-dancing melons that pour showers of syrup over his body. Yup. Now, if you think that's crazy.
Family show, Jim.
I know. But if you think that's crazy, and it is a little bit, think about American movies' obsession with guns. So the moral for the day is no reason to be melodramatic over this.
Or melancholy.
We are all weird in our own wonderful ways.
Yeah, you turned that one around. I like it. All right. My hubbub today is that Vermont is calling, ladies and gentlemen, because they are offering, the great state of Vermont is offering to pay people $10,000 if you would move to Vermont, and they would help you set up broadband, co-working office space, things like that, so that you could telecommute back to your jobs wherever they are. I know. See, Jim's leaning back and he's like, "Mate, this sounds pretty good." Because Vermont's got an aging population. They want to bring in sort of more, they want to bring in younger workers, families, whatever. And what I love is CNBC wrote about this, and they said that while the state may be rich in beautiful landscapes and maple syrup, it has a rapidly shrinking tax base. But, you know, I was thinking, this is actually a great, I think it's a great idea. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I am the host of Radio Boston, so I'm probably going to stick around here because I love the city. But imagine all the jobs that could effectively be done through some kind of telecommuting. And maybe you'd have to, like, come back to the city or the region once or twice a week. But Vermont's not that far away. And for the cost of a one bedroom in Boston, you could buy a farm in Vermont practically. So
it's good. And the weather's nice for about 6 weeks.
You're tugging at my heart. I know. Okay, that's true. Well, it's not any better down here.
It's true.
All right. Well, Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston Magazine, thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure. Thank
and Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute, thank you as well.
Have a great weekend.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.